Hey, nice people, welcome to another episode of Web3FM. Today we are talking about decentralized science, and our guests are Joshua Bate, founder of DeciWorld, and Filip Milenković, initiator of DeciWorld Belgrade community. Yeah, we had these days also the DeciWorld conference. You joined your forces and created the world of DeciWorld Belgrade. So this was a good time for you to come here. So thank you, first of all, for coming and being willing to talk with us about important topic, which is decentralizing the science.
No, so, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
So let's then deep dive into it straight away. If you are to talk about DeciWorld, as such, first natural topic is basically talking about definition and explanation of decentralized science. So Josh, can you help us in understanding in what is the DeSci in itself?
So decentralized science, or DeSci, is a movement creating public infrastructure to improve the way that science is done, is conducted, the way that we disseminate information, the way that scientists are incentivized, the way that funding sources are created for research. Globally is the intention, but it's not exclusively a global movement. It's just almost exclusively Web3 based, so using the decentralized infrastructure such as Ethereum or other blockchains. Cardano is also very popular in the DeSci space. So it's basically improving every aspect possible of the current scientific infrastructure using the Web3 tech stack.
Do you see that? So you name a couple of directions that DeSci can go. Do you see that one of the, like, what was the first one? Was it like overall problems with let's call it centralized science or science as such? Or do you see that at some point from various directions this DeSci movement started?
Yeah, I mean, so DeSci movement has generally started out of the open science movement, which has come for the past two or three decades, is the concept of open sourcing science and data, access to resources, access to funding. There's a huge precedent of open science that has come before DeSci. DeSci is taking these thoughts, these lessons, and putting them onto the blockchain in particular. The sort of first real iteration of DeSci, apart from, you know, organization of people using DAOs, et cetera, was probably the research funding aspect in particular. And this is because DeFi has been built over the past 3 or 4 years, and DeFi and funding are essentially the same thing. It's just the application of the DeFi tooling, of the crowdsourcing, of the tokenization, et cetera, which has been built over the past few years in DeFi, has just been repurposed in specific for research funding. So the largest and most complete landscape right now in DeSci is the research funding landscape, but there's many other parts to it, you know, organization, data handling, incentive mechanisms, all these sorts of things. But right now the largest and most prolific is the funding landscape.
So maybe Filip, you can help us with this. Let's deep dive into a funding moment. So what are the major ways to that disrupt current way of funding from the DeSci perspective?
Well, what I like about all of this is that, like, a lot of people, retail, regular people, can actually come together, organize themselves, self-organize, and actually collect money and then distribute to causes that they care about. And that's a very interesting from experimentation standpoint. And there are very cool organizations, DAO organizations, that are actually funding very specific niche things in science, like longevity, psychedelic medicines, and stuff like that. And from my personal perspective, I would quote Shelley as a political... Shelley, there's this great... Mm-hmm. He's a great British poet who was actually a political poet in his first years of producing. He has this quote, "You are many, they are few." And I really like the idea that people are getting together online, and online communities actually collect funds and then try to distribute and actually fund something that they think it's important. And along the way are actually inventing new things, both technologically and legally, that could actually and eventually, like in a longer period of time, become like mainstream ways to
fund. And this is a question for both of you. What are the new technical ways of funding the project. I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is, for example, idea of retroactive public goods funding or quadratic funding. So,
yes, I mean, we can start with that. So retroactive public goods funding is a fantastic way to incentivize scientists to do the work. The idea here is that you can do science for the love of doing it. And if there is a future social benefit or any benefit, some organization who's interested in RGPF can give you some funding retroactively for the work that you've done. This is great as an incentive for people to do good and then potentially get the funding, but it's very difficult to apply this to research in general because research is typically more capital intensive. So to get that initial startup and then do that, like bootstrap that and then get it retroactively is not so convenient for many. So quadratic funding is another great idea in the sense that you can basically get people who don't have a particularly large amount of capital, but have a large interest to stake their claim on who deserves a pool of funding. For example, Gitcoin does this famously. And actually DeSci, there was a DeSci Gitcoin round in GR15. So you could actually donate and get it matched by the Gitcoin Foundation through the quadratic funding system. So that's great. I mean, so those are brand new primitives in the sort of DeFi crypto space right now for funding, but an extension of this. So generally tokenization itself is a fantastic funding mechanism because you can spin up a token, which generates, you can distribute the ownership of the protocol, of the research that you're producing, right? And that's a massive incentive for people to get behind a research objective because you can not only own not only can you advance the science, but you can actually own a portion of the protocol that builds the science. And an extension there of that is something such as the IP NFT, which has been developed by Molecule, which is a bit of a flagship in the DeSci space right now. The IP NFT is taking an off-chain IP agreement and bringing it on-chain to enable composability with things like fractionalization, using it as collateral, governing the distribution of this NFT or the access to this IP through things like token gating and token gated governance. So these are some core funding mechanisms. Is the obviously the retroactive public goods funding is good, but it's a bit difficult to apply that to research because research generally is quite intensive, capital intensive. So this is more for maybe early stage research, maybe your PhD research or some kind of
initial idea.
Exactly, the initial ideas. And again, that's scientists generally will pursue a research idea because they're passionate about it. And the issue that we sort of faced, I don't want to sort of go ahead here, but the issue that's being faced in traditional academia is that if you have a passionate idea about some kind of interest, if you want to pursue that, it's very difficult to find the funding unless that idea is in the pursuit of a goal of some kind of institution or a corporate private business, for example. So I have an interest in a molecule and what effect it has on the human body. So I want to research that, but maybe the only way to get funding to cover my costs is if I research that molecule in terms of its application for a cleaning product, for example, or a pharmaceutical product, for example. And that might cause me to change my research objective. So to get that initial funding for the ideas that you want to pursue in a decentralized manner is incredibly powerful for scientists to have the incentive to do the science they want to do. So the retroactive public goods funding does work in that way, but it's a little bit more restrictive because to get that initial funding in a decentralized manner is more powerful.
So let's stick more with the retroactive public goods funding. Maybe in some basically not a use case, but maybe some example can help in when does this work and when it doesn't work. So basically in contrast to the classical funding where I need to basically apply for a grant, get the money, do the research, after that apply for another grant, get the money, do the research. Here it doesn't function like that. So if we want to scale this in a way for it to be not mainstream, but to have some critical mass of people doing it like that, what do you see as benefits and maybe problems with it? So how? Let's start first with maybe some example of stuff done here, maybe something we understood.
Yeah, so I mean, one of the most classic examples of retroactive public goods funding working well is in the Ethereum builder community, the core dev community, because a lot of very passionate developers on the Ethereum community will develop some kind of protocol like Etherscan, for example, or one of these, and they'll do a fantastic work and it provides an incredible benefit to the Ethereum ecosystem. And then the foundation will recognize this and then retroactively fund them for their work. So this is a fantastic thing for passion projects and things such as this.
Yeah, the question is how would that scale in a design manner? So as a researcher want to do to act in a world where the retroactive public goods funding is a thing.
Yeah. So there needs to be a framework for it, right? So the Ethereum Foundation will do this for things in the Ethereum ecosystem, but they won't specifically do it for research. So what needs to come first is this critical mass of the DeSci retroactive public goods funding ecosystem, such that a scientist can almost reliably know that if they do good science and it does have a public good effect, that there's a good chance they'll receive retroactive funding. Because right now there's basically no infrastructure for that. So if you're hoping to go and get RGPF, you're kind of like, you know, wishing upon a wish. Right now, there is no precedent for that happening in DeSci, and there's no massive infrastructure. In maybe, you know, 2 to 5 years, as DeSci begins to scale, as people become much more aware of its impact factor, these funds will spin up. Is it the Ethereum Foundation? Mm-hmm. Is it the NIH in America? Who knows? But there will be these funds that retroactively reward scientists for their work. But for the moment, there's no precedent for that. So it's very difficult for a scientist to rely on that retroactive funding for their science.
Similar to, for example, I don't know, Turing Award or something like that, you cannot know that you will basically win Turing Award. So,
but there is the Turing Award. The Turing Award is a concept that people know about, right? Like, you know that somebody will get some kind of retroactive reward in that way. But this, there is actually no infrastructure that is available right now at all. So it's even less likely.
Yeah, Philip, what's your opinion about retroactive public goods?
I think it's very interesting, but like, I think the question, why blockchain? Because that way you can track contributions of many different people in a way that, you can track that, like, and do that, like, retroactive funding, like, even years after something was actually done. But as Josh said, it's like, it's still early on, as in, like, it's just in a conceptual phase, I would probably say. But it's very interesting as a mechanism, because you can track and actually reward someone who contributed to something like even decades ago.
Then let's talk about why blockchain. Why blockchain is a must, and Philip, basically, why for decentralized science you need the blockchain? If you need it.
Right. So I mean,
is it just because decentralized science is such emerged from a blockchain community, if it did, or is it like really needing a blockchain as such?
Well, I think, as just explained, it is like a crypto or Web3 phenomenon as a concept. Of course, you can do science in an open manner without blockchain itself. And like the whole open data, open access thing came with the internet. And then with the blockchain, there are certain features of the technology that are perfectly suited for new phenomenon that were actually impossible like 20 or 30 years ago, I would say. So for example, imagine like different online communities hanging out on forums and whatnot, like in 92, and that's cool, they're collaborating. But now, like 30 years after, they can have something encoded and have proper governance, and they can tokenize and do things that were not possible before. So I see it as an emerging phenomenon. And there are certain features of the technology, for example, like decentralized storage or censorship resistant features that are suited for certain things and issues in science itself, because unfortunately there's so many censoring online and stuff like that. So you can actually use this to archive things, and unfortunately the world is headed into the direction where things are being forbidden. So I think certain features are being investigated that there are no other technological approaches to solve some of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because DeSci, there's many applications for blockchain, right? For the decentralized infrastructure. For me personally, DeSci is the most powerful and the most salient because of those things that you mentioned. Like, censorship resistance is important in basically every walk of life, including finance, but especially in science, right? Because, you know, the impact that controlled science or hidden science can have on the general population, especially scientists who generally just want to research the world around them to find out the truth of what they're looking at. And when you have certain certain hypotheses, certain research objects, certain data that's hidden and impacts the scientists' work when they're just trying to get to the truth, this is a big problem, because it underpins basically our entire existence, is what the world is made up around us. So, and misinformation, disinformation is real, and we know that state actors are not immune to issuing misinformation and disinformation. And so the blockchain helps to sort of solve many of those issues. And I would agree with Philip that the DeSci infrastructure, DeSci in general, is inherently blockchain-based. There is a bit of a debate, I will say, for my DeSci peers about whether or not DeSci needs blockchain. Even in my own team, Jelani, he's on our team, he mentions that DeSci will just go wherever it needs to. And if the decentralized blockchain or Ethereum in particular, or just these blockchains are not the right place for DeSci to work, then it will go somewhere else. I personally am in the camp of the DE part of DeSci is the decentralized blockchain, allowing sovereign access, sovereign ownership, tokenization, these things, which is pivotal. But some will argue that DeSci is just the concept of decentralizing science, like the open science movement did, but the underlying infrastructure is not pivotal, but that's not me.
So then that is a question of, let's call it, motivation behind the emergence of decentralized science. Is it like, when you think about it, is DeSci started from the Web3 blockchain world, like, or did it start from academia? So
started from the open science movement more than anything.
So then, in short, can we tackle the open science movement? Like, in a couple of sentences, what's the idea of it all? So,
well, if something is open, like, first of all, like, you have open access, as in, like, you have access to knowledge you can use, and you can use everything freely. And the value there or belief there is that, like, science should be open to anyone, and that knowledge should be open and free. And that means that, like, as a consequence, if knowledge is open, mm-hmm. there's more knowledge being generated, the world gets so much better. And with the emergence of the internet, like, people started, you know, putting their scientific work online and made it openly accessible. In the early 90s, I would probably say mm-hmm. it was impossible prior to that, and people are frustrated with, like, the publishing industry.
Is it similar to the concept of learning in public or something totally different?
Well, from the strictly data perspective, like, it's just the data, scientific data should be open for anyone
to
use.
So it's not just learning in public, it's more of a, like, I will share the data with you, I will share my
data, scientific work, and all of that. Especially, I mean, people are frustrated because, for example, coming from Serbia, like, it's expensive to have access to certain knowledge, right? Because you need to pay a lot of money to these publishers. And then people are frustrated. As a counter initiative, people are willing to freely share all of their work with others globally. And that's the ideal. And I think that's great for the world. And now with, like, crypto and Web3, there are ways to actually build upon that. I'm not 100% sure about the history of open science movement.
I mean, you can look at some things like Sci-Hub, for example. Sci-Hub is a very popular example. Sci-Hub is a repository, like an online library, with scientific papers that typically would be paywalled in a journal, right? And the publishing aspect of DeSci is, in my opinion, one of the most important parts. Mm-hmm. Publishers run a monopoly on access to knowledge, and they profit massively from it. And it has some benefits, for example, like verifiability, reputation, distribution methods, all these things. But it is a monopoly, it's a cartel, and it's completely counterproductive to innovation and to improving the access to knowledge. So Sci-Hub actually tackled this by basically giving open access to papers that were typically paywalled. And it's been blocked on many global servers, you know, the UK, EU, US, etc. You can find many proxies right now, Sci-Hub. It's a fantastic site. Most researchers will use it. It's one of those things where once you sort of know about Sci-Hub and you talk to researchers, they all use it. And it's sort of a dirty little secret. And so open science is this in a nutshell, but it's open science is typically more quote unquote law abiding mm-hmm. within the confines of what's allowed, because scientists generally just want to do their work. They don't want to get into trouble with the law. They don't particularly want to disrupt or rock the boat so much. And so open science was towing the line between, right, how do we improve science, but how do we also not, you know, cause structural issues? And DeSci is, you know, for me in particular, I feel like DeSci is a bit more of a structural conflict against this kind of traditional academic infrastructure, but far less so than DeFi, right? So mm-hmm. again, open finance existed before DeFi, but DeFi is a massive challenger to the traditional financial system. It would almost displace, you know, it doesn't have to, but it will, it's much more of a conflict between DeFi and TradFi In DeSci, it's less of a conflict. It's more of a symbiotic relationship, but it is more, I suppose, more impactful than the open science movement was.
So then how do you see that this will move forward? Like, do you see that traditional science, academia, let's call it like that, I don't know what's the right word.
I say trad sci, but people get offended by that. So.
Yeah, okay, traditional way of, the mainstream way of doing science, and the decentralized science, there are a couple of possible scenarios. One is obviously traditional science, trad sci here, will take some like things from DeSci and onboard them, or DeSci can totally basically remove the traditional science in by basically creating its own procedures, culture, and like moving the academia from one process to another. How do you see this evolving? So do you see, you said that it's some kind of symbiotic, but in the long term, do you see that academia in such current ways will stop existing and move to a DeSci, or like, you know, I remember phrase, I cannot recollect it in a, precisely, but somebody said like academia at some point will move from universities. You know, like academia needs freedom, and at some point in time it will move away from universities because it doesn't have freedom. So
yeah, I mean, so look, I need to make a disclaimer here and say that I do not speak for DeSci World in this, and I do not speak for DeSci in general at all. This is my personal feelings about the situation. I think that there is no way that DeSci will succeed if it does not integrate effectively and positively with the current traditional academic system, because scientists are much more risk adverse than financiers, and they will go where it's easier or most efficient to do science, yes, but they will not, you know, generally they will not go where it's illegal to do so, or it will sort of affect their ability to do science in a compliant manner. So for DeSci to succeed, what does success look like? It's another mm-hmm. question, but for DeSci to succeed, it must integrate effectively and positively with traditional academia. I do think DeSci will be the dominant scientific model in maybe not even 10 years. That's my personal thoughts. And I think, as you say about the universities in particular, like, so universities are a fantastic institution. They bring the best minds together. They help to incubate the great ideas. But what they do is they have a monopoly on knowledge, and they have a monopoly on reputation. So if you want to be a scientist and you want to be respected, more often than not, you have to have gone to one of these universities to have done so. There are examples of, you know, absolute geniuses who have made their own way by building inventions in their garage at home and then releasing it and improving the world. But these are few and far in between. And often to get to the point where you have access to the resources to build these great, or to make these great research goals, you have to have gone to a university in the first place to get access. So, you know, universities monopolize knowledge, monopolize research, monopolize talent. And the world is sort of fighting actively against monopolies, because monopolies have, you know, quote unquote, screwed us for a long time. So I do see that as knowledge becomes open access, as access to equipment and generally just resources and knowledge and collaboration becomes much more decentralized, the university will have a less important place in the world. And that, you know, the problem with the universities are they have a history, right? And the history is part of the reputation, but the history is also the incumbency. So, you know, for example, Oxford and Cambridge, yes, because of their history, they attract the best talent, but because of their history, they have a power to do as they will and to direct science in the direction that they want to be, they want it to be directed. These are sort of dogmatic narrative controls that traditional academia thrives off of. And the reason that we have been innovating in such a specific direction for so many decades is because of the narratives that academia wants us to push. Now, I could go very, very deep here onto some examples of, you know.
Please. Because it's an interesting topic, because.
Just any other word.
Because basically we are aware of a problem, but we do not know currently what is a solution. If DeSci is offering some solutions, I'm talking about direction of the science problem, monopoly and stuff like that. So maybe if you understand a better problem, and then
if I can just, yeah, okay.
Please.
No, I mean, basically who funds controls is like sets the direction, right? So there's a huge power of that. Like you're incentivizing people and giving them like a certain direction to explore and nudging them.
It's like a trifecta, right? Mm-hmm. You've got the funders and the universities or the students, mm-hmm. and then the sort of the publishers or the distributors of science. And the funders is one part of that. You know, so the funders require the universities to have the direction and the talent and stuff in order to fund, and the publishers require the funding and the universities for the reputation. So this sort of trifecta means mm-hmm. that there is, yes, funding is massively important, and without funding, science wouldn't happen, and that controls a lot, but it's not the only control. Intellectual control is a real thing. Narrative control, dogmatic control is a real concept. You know, the Catholic Church was very successful because it was so rich, but it also captured the mind, not just the purses of the population. And there's a good example, which I will briefly touch on. I don't want to go too deep on mm-hmm. it because, again, I'm representing DeSci World here. There's a very famous book called Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. And Aldous Huxley wrote in Brave New World about this sort of techno-futurist environment where we had, you know, surveillance states and we had things like synthetic wombs mm-hmm. And things that, you know, 80 years ago were completely alien. And actually now we're working on them currently. You know, Vitalik is a very strong proponent of the synthetic womb, for example. And if you look at, if you look at the familial history of they're the intelligentsia, right? Mm-hmm. They're the people who, the men of letters who controlled a lot of, they're very well respected. So if you look at, for example, Aldous Huxley's brother, Julian Huxley. So Julian Huxley is a very famous man in many circles, but they're sort of like originally the sort of, the eugenic circles, right? You know, he believed in a certain future in which society would move so effectively and powerfully in the right direction that science would be, you know, the innovation would be extreme. And he was actually very close with people like Charles Darwin and Francis Galton and these other elite scientists in the UK and in the US around that period. And, you know, he's the brother of Aldous Huxley, who then wrote a book about Brave New World, this dystopian novel of this techno-futurist environment, right? So he was obviously getting some information from his brother, who was right in the heart of all of these innovative ideas, these discussions in the early 19th century, and 20th century, sorry. So he synthesizes these ideas and writes a novel, which we think is literature. Now, that novel is taught to everybody in the UK, right? At school, it's almost mandatory reading. So from a young age, my parents as well would read Brave New World, and they'd have this idea of what the future looks like. And that was developed, that was written by a man whose brother was right in the center of the intelligentsia of the futurist sort of thinkers, who actually their intention was to build society in their own image as a white man, right? And these are real things. And these are real things. And this is the control of the intellectual capital, right? This is the control of the mind that the intelligentsia, i.e. universities, elite universities in particular, they capture the narrative such as this. And now we are actually producing what is being written about in Brave New World. So in the space of 80 to 100 years, these ideas were theorized, written into literature, told to everybody, and the same universities that theorize them are now building them. And we are, you know, pro supporters of it. Vitalik, who is, you know, everybody's favorite person. Yeah. He's a massive proponent of these things. And for very good reasons, as he gives very valid data points as to why we need this for women's health and et cetera. And it's true, but you can spin anything. And you just need to understand that this apparatus of narrative control exists, and the decentralized science is an answer, hopefully, against this, because it allows you to decentralize the thought process, decentralize the narrative control in particular.
I mean, also, like, if you look at, like, how was R&D funded throughout, like, history, right? Like, I read some cool paper. We could, like, share it. Like, maybe you can put it in the show notes or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
It's interesting. Like, I don't know, 500 years ago, like, central government was not that, you know, big and ineffective. And then there were some wealthy people who were funding stuff. And then the nation state emerged, blah, blah, blah. And then at some point, like, there's no, for example, there's no private equity at some point. Someone invents venture capital at some point. So that becomes a vehicle to fund stuff, right? Then you have corporations with their big budgets and stuff. And what's new now is that like a lot of people who don't know each other, who met online, can coordinate and fund very interesting projects that just wasn't possible before. And I see that as a very interesting angle. Like you can imagine like 2 million people who are coordinating and have a budget of the size of like, you know, a Serbian budget for science, which is really interesting. And what's also interesting is a cultural phenomenon that like, that's how you and I met. Like we met online, but we immediately clicked. So we're part of this like online internet first kind of a tribe. And if we share some values, so basically you can imagine people who share values becoming this tribe, but not just tribe, but actually a mechanism to fund certain
I never connected network states with the DSI. So when you talk about this, does it in any way, well, is it compatible or does it origin from the same?
Yeah, I mean,
I never thought about it.
Zuzalu, you heard of Zuzalu? Zuzalu,
yeah.
Well, that was headed by Vitalik and Vitadao. And Vitadao is actually one of the biggest projects in DSI. They were the main organizers. It was Vitalik helping with organizing and funding and ideering with local governments, etc. Well, local representatives, sorry. But Vitadao was one of the main organizing forces behind it. And Vitadao is specifically it's a branch of Molecule, which I mentioned does the IP NFT. And they're specifically focused on longevity research and longevity medicine. So, you know, extending the lifespan or improving the amount of healthy human life years in particular. And so Zuzalu was about many things: public goods funding, ZK research, AI, extinction risks, longevity as well. But a big focus was the longevity. And even within the Zuzalu, because I was there for 2 weeks, even within the Zuzalu sort of environment, many people were taking part in longevity type activities like fasting, you know, not drinking alcohol, taking cold plunges in the morning, doing runs and other sort of health, you know, healthy activities, good positive activities. And it was based around this sort of longevity aspect. So really very prominent longevity enthusiasts were there. It was one of the greatest meetings of minds in that space, probably ever, especially in the decentralized space. So for the longevity community, it was huge. So the network state, this kind of goes into, you know, what Philip just mentioned there about people with similar interests, with similar vibes, having the ability to fund things that they want to fund. This is kind of what the network state is. And it has many positives. For example, the longevity community have now advanced themselves massively, but it also has some limitations, which I'm sure we'll touch on later, but the network state in general can form around anything. And it just whoever has the wherewithal to bring people together and to help fund it is what the sort of it will be based around. You know, you can go to Prospera in Honduras and there's many people there who are interested in other things. And that's been going on for nearly a decade now. So Zuzalu is one. It was not explicitly focused around longevity, but by the fact that it was organized and funded by people who are interested in that, it invariably became about that. So there are some limitations and concerns about this concept, which we can touch on later. But yeah, so that the DSI and network state in this particular example are very closely linked.
If I can add one interesting perspective, that's regulation, because like it's illegal to do certain scientific discoveries in certain countries. And then if you have the ability to actually get out of a certain regulatory environment, which can be done in coordination with the central government. So for example, I mean, there are like, I think it's like for, it's like legal theory and political science and whatnot, but like you can have like space where you can do certain experiments that are illegal and just do them, because a lot of science is illegal for whatever reason. And quite often it's ideological reasons. And why not actually give scientists the opportunity to experiment, and especially if some people are ready to do that.
Yeah, there's a whole host of people who are very interested and ready to self-experiment with longevity.
For example,
you know, gene therapies in general. I know people personally who have had, you know, designer gene therapies created, and they've injected them and self-experimented to see, you know, if they can improve their strength or their protein synthesis efficiencies, etc. And so for the longevity community, whilst this is not necessarily a stated goal, the network state provides an opportunity where they might experiment maybe on themselves or with consenting parties. I'm not saying this is being done in a dystopian manner. It's just this, as Philip mentioned, there are some regulations which people want to skirt, and the network state is a potential way to do so. you know, the international waters, taking a big boat out into international waters and doing what you want out there is basically a floating network state in its primitive form. But the network state is making it such that it's on the ground with, you know, with infrastructure and some kind of governance, in particular, normally with crypto related governance, but it's not exclusively.
So let me get back to the, you mentioned trifecta, like investment, fundraising, then academia, like universities, and then publishers. So we tackled a little bit the topic of the investment side, like retroactive public goods funding and such. But let's tackle the from the DeFi perspective, the other two. You talked about the university, so maybe we can tackle the third side of it all, like publishing. So what are the problems you see that currently DeFi is trying to disrupt there?
Yeah, I mean, so just as a basic example, if you're a practicing scientist and you want to do some science and get it published, so this is typically the flow you'll have to go through. You'll have to, you know, be educated, typically go to university and pay a lot of money to do so and rarely earn any money in that process, accrue lots of debt. And then you decide, right, to spend, you know, a year or more researching and theorizing your idea, creating a research grant proposal, maybe dozens of research grant proposals. A lot of researchers will complain about spending more time writing grant proposals than actually doing the research. And this is very common. So you look for grants everywhere. Hopefully you can get a grant that wants to fund the exact science you're interested in. More often than not, you have to sort of change the scientific hypothesis to fit their interests. Anyway, so then you get the money and then you do the science. And then you've got this paper. And for Nature, Springer Nature, which is one of the, I think, the most popular, most used publisher, I think the going rate is about $28,000 to $30,000 to have your paper published in Nature. Now, as a scientist, as a practicing scientist, you want this published in Nature for the reputation, for the prestige, so that people might then build off of your research and improve that, you know, the science in that direction. So you have to pay a serious amount of money. And unless you have someone sponsoring you to do so, again, very difficult. And then not only do you have to pay to have it published, you then have to pay to read it as well. So you have to then pay the subscription fees to read it. So this is obviously a very broken system. And it's because it's cartelized, it's monopolized. So you're priced out of it. And recently, I think Guardian released an article maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago about Elsevier, which is another top publisher. I think it was 20 or 30 of their top editors walked out in protest about the restrictive fees, the fees that they were charging on publishing. So, you know, it's something that's obviously at a breaking point. And I actually spoke with a representative of a top publisher. I won't mention her. And they said that the innovation departments within these organizations are actually ready to shake up the models because they see that people are sick of it. They see that they're about to be displaced by more innovative models, more egalitarian models. And it's just like, you know, when Coca-Cola started carbon offsetting their plastic bottles. They don't do that because they care. They do that because they think people will go elsewhere if they don't start making an effort in the social direction. And I think that these big corporations will be doing the same. And apparently, according to this person, these people are open to actually adopting DeFi techniques, decentralized publishing models. In particular, you know, tokenization of the papers or changing the incentive mechanisms such that you can get paid per citation, for example. This is something I've been looking into. So the publishing models are very fundamentally broken. They're very anti-innovation. They're very anti-science in general. There's very, very little incentive for a scientist to go and do career science. Normally, you just sort of get your PhD, which even I know many PhDs who didn't finish because they thought, what's the fucking point, right? And then either that or you go into industry or into some kind of corporate science. And in that case, you often sell your dreams and sell your principles in order to get the money that your studies have sort of deserved.
Do you see that this organization will adapt, the mechanisms of DeFi, or do you see that maybe there are DeFi startups who are tackling this right and have a chance in disrupting this?
Yeah, I mean, so I know a number of DeFi startups who are tackling this. So shout out to SciNFT, S-C-I-E, NFT, Rob Walters, fantastic person. SciSets is another project. Both of these have MVPs live right now. And they're doing some great stuff in the decentralized publishing space. But the big issue with all of this is that publishers do one thing and one thing only. Yes, they have distribution models and et cetera, but they're archaic at best. The thing that publishers have a monopoly on is the reputation. So the reputation of a publishing, of a paper, of a journal is the thing that causes people to pay $30,000 per submission. So these decentralized funding publishing models don't have that at the moment. And that's going to be a big struggle for, because as a corporation or as a funder, this is this trifecta, right? If you're published in Nature, you're going to get funded, right? But if you're not published in Nature, maybe you won't get funded, and maybe you won't go to a certain academic institution or et cetera, right? So the reputation keeps this whole thing together, keeps the monopoly together. And that's going to be a difficult thing for DeSci to breach by itself, which is why I say that DeSci must, in order to succeed, DeSci must positively integrate with the current system. So making, for example, making a platform that allows you to publish in a decentralized manner, but then going to Springer Nature, to their innovation department and saying, hey, look, let's do a proof of concept here. Let's start publishing some with the Springer Nature stamp of approval. How about we produce a Springer Nature verified reputation model that can be put on chain? So you have an academic credentialing model that has the Springer Nature stamp of approval. Again, fundamentally, I disagree with this because it's not truly DeSci, but it's the sort of thing that would be required in order to get that legitimacy that we need.
And so basically, in short, reputation as a mechanism still needs to exist. And
I mean, it does exist, and it's hard to circumnavigate that. Yeah. Does it need to exist? That's a philosophical question, right?
Probably.
We don't have currently, from the DeSci or any other standpoint, a solution for that.
We do. We have academic credentialing systems. So shout out Holonym. They're launching their alpha very soon. They've written 60,000 lines of code in 2 months, which is comparable to sort of Gitcoin. They're producing an academic credentialing system, which is privacy preserving. So it's ZK. So it utilizes the university system. So you can sort of have your degree logged. And so this person has a degree that's capable of, that's up to a certain standard, but without revealing where they went to university. That's one aspect. But also, you can begin to build an on-chain profile. So if someone contributes to a whole bunch of on-chain DeSci efforts, this can be, tracked using the blockchain, and that can be accrued to a wallet address, for example. It's hard to maintain privacy under that respect, but you still can. But you can begin to build this on-chain reputation. And it's something that's very important. People, lots of hackathons around the world are working on this, especially ZK. So reputation is being built, but it's the perception of that reputation, right? If you're building an on-chain reputation, how important, how much value do people give that? It's more, people still value, did you go to Harvard? Did you go to Stanford, et cetera?
Traditional stuff. So one also topic that is interesting by its own, but also in this trifecta moment, may be open data thing. So obviously somebody is keeping the closed data. There was a research or whatever, I cannot recollect, but usually the papers are written in such a form that the data can be on demand sent to the person if they need the data to check the results. But somebody was, like, for example, asking 500 papers, the people behind them, to get the data, and like majority of them basically refused or sent some non-reliable data. So
From the DeSci perspective. Or not machine readable or something like
that. Yeah, so something that you cannot use, basically. So I guess DeSci is also tackling this, but do you see this as a major problem or something that will be solved at some point in time once the reputation or whatever works? So.
Well, I think the interesting angle there is about commons, because you could argue that a lot of scientific data should be treated as like true global commons, something of value. And if you store it in a way that it can't be taken away, that's good for like all the future research. And there are examples of like some data disappearing from the internet. People were using Web3 tech in China, for example, to share some COVID data that was missing. I think that even Trump took off some ecological data or something. So then there were activists who were like putting that on chain using, I think, decentralized storage, and that way made it like accessible to all the future scientists. And the whole archiving thing is also very interesting there, because you can archive using Filecoin or Viva or other methods and use that as a as a body for scientific future sometime in the future. And also, if something is public first, so to say, that is like almost automatically some sort of open data. And since more and more science is actually done by computing of actual data, that's like a great resource for advancement of many different fields, actually. Not just like sociology, but even political science, biology, psychology. So like if you have some things that is digital and can be used and utilized by machine learning, that's actually very good for advancement of science in many different domains.
It allows you to monetize your data sets much more effectively, right?
Plus that, yeah.
You know, the Web2 has basically been so user-friendly because it's been backed by massive corporations, and most often it's been free, like using Google, for example. But, you know, the famous saying, if you're not paying for it, then you are the salary, right? You are the income. Your data is what they're using to monetize. And Web3 allows you to... You know, in many ways, it's less efficient to use Web3 for data transfer and data storage, but it does provide that additional benefit of traceability or verification, but also allows you to, in many ways, monetize your own data sets. So there's a project called Genomes DAO, and they've been running around since 2021, so they're quite early. You can send off for a full genomic sequencing kit, and then you send it to them, and they take your genomic sequencing data, and then they store it in a smart contract vault with some biomarkers on it. So a corporation can say, well, I know that this person has a genetic adversity to caffeine, and I want to know more about his genetic data set, his genomic data, but you can't find out the underlying data. Then they can pay you to use your data. And this is just an interesting use case for, you know, monetizing your own data set. So it improves everything in many ways in terms of the traceability, the verification, the reproducibility, but also it allows you to monetize your own data.
Is the main way for an organization to exist inside of this DAO? You mentioned a couple of DAOs. Is this something that is usual?
Yeah, I mean, so the DAO is just, the DAO is a bit of a meme, right? So there's that famous Republican in name only, the Rhino, right? Well, I like to use the term Dino, which is the DAO in name only. And there's many DAOs which are dinos because they're not truly decentralized, and the token gated governance is a bit of a sham. You know, tokens are controlled by a very, most of the token supply, and therefore the control is controlled by a very small portion of insiders. So it's not truly decentralized. And again, the A in DAO, decentralized autonomous organization, that is also a bit of a sham for the most part, because most DAOs are not automated in their execution. Typically a vote will go through and then somebody has to go and move the funds around or manually execute on that. Yeah, manually. So, you know, these are all early stage things, but it is a very efficient way to organize yourself, to organize your resources and your funds. One of my favorite people in DeSci, a guy called Eugene Leventhal, such an OG, he described a DAO as a group of people that don't agree, but have a common mission. And I think that's the most effective way for a DAO to work, is for you to not have sycophancy, right? To not have people really believing so much in the same thing, because that generates a lot of dogma, right? But the best way to have it is just a shared treasury almost, and then for people to sort of collaborate around this idea, around this common goal. And that's basically what most scientists do, but without having control over their finances. So the DAO allows you to control your treasury and maybe govern the protocol with tokenomics or whatever, change the incentive mechanisms such that if you contribute in a certain way to the research goals, you'll receive more of the governance tokens, for example. This is much more flexible, and that's why scientists find it, you know, quite valuable. Typically, organization within science is really limited, such that if you're at a university and there's a private research institution a mile down the road, you could be working on the same problem and crunching the same data sets and not know. And you're wasting a lot of time and money and resources in that. So the DAO, by the standardization of the blockchain, everything being on kind of the same blockchain, using the same sort of token infrastructure, makes it much easier for them to collaborate. And internally within the DAO makes them much easier to collaborate as well. But, you know, are these true DAOs? Probably not, but that's okay, because the DAO ecosystem isn't that complete right now.
Do you think that the autonomous part of this organization is something that DeSci wants to achieve, or maybe it just doesn't need to happen? It's enough to have decentralized organization?
I mean, it depends on your use case, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you are doing an execution layer such that, okay, we make a decision on how the funds should be spent. If you automate that, right, depending on your outlook, that's a good thing because then people can't tamper with the funds, which is a big issue, but it's a bad thing because it's then irreversible. And maybe the decision, if someone manipulates the token gated governance, this happens all the time, then they irreversibly send this money. You know, there's a very famous example of an early DeFi project that had a, you know, $10 million treasury. Someone bought loads of the governance tokens, voted on a proposal to say, send me, you know, send this wallet address the entire treasury. And then they voted yes. And then he just got sent the entire treasury because that was what the DAO voted. It's a silly example, but it's true. And I think that generally the use case is dependent. I think for many things, the autonomous aspect is very important, especially for, you know, highly democratic requirements. Like there should be a real democracy involved in terms of this should be the people's data, the commons, as Philip mentioned, but some things are a bit more sensitive and a bit more risque. They should be less automated.
We mentioned the universities, the fundraising aspect of it all, the open data and basically the publishing. Philip, is it all? What else is in this eye something that is interesting to us? So did we cover all the aspects of this eye? Or
did I miss anything?
Obviously, there are use cases, but if
inspiration? As in, like, people can change their behavior?
Yeah, they can change the world through science, and DeSci enables you to do so.
Right, yeah, but psychological, but, like, what else there is? Is an industry?
In terms of, like, infrastructure?
Yeah, for example.
Maybe we can tackle it from interesting project standpoint. Maybe we can tackle it like this. What are you working on? So,
cool.
So, yeah.
Okay, so this kind of is the inspiration part, right?
Right.
So at DeSci World, we're building community infrastructure for the decentralized science space. We're doing many things. We have data aggregation on our dashboard on our website. So it's like, you know, you can go and see 85 projects right now listed. You can see what jobs are available across the DeSci ecosystem, what events are happening. We're doing real world events. So Philip and I collaborated on this World of DeSci conference. It's something that we're making our sort of one of our flagship products is to go around the world and showcase DeSci projects to local communities, in particular outside of Western Europe and North America, which is why we piloted in Belgrade. It's sort of a nice in between, but we're going to go further afield, you know, Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, etc. So we're building these mechanisms both online and offline, you know, virtual and social, in order to empower the DeSci community, to get people connected, to make it easier for you to get funding, to get outreach, and to sort of, you know, find your home in this very, very early ecosystem. And the reason we're doing that is because there are monopolies in every industry, including in DeSci. And we want people to feel inspired to actually go and pursue something a bit different, to pursue, I like to use this phrase, to pursue your own truth, right? Because people need to realize that science has been very narrative controlled for a couple thousand years. You know, Western Judeo-Christian schools of thought have led us down a very singular innovation path, and that's great. But there are other schools of thought. Many people have grown up in indigenous communities with other concepts of like socialism, the social aspect of life, your spirit, and all these things, which we don't really understand. And some things are undeniable, like our knowledge of the physical universe, the material science can be debated. And you know, atheism has brought all kinds of interesting concepts about the unexplained, about trying to explain it with unproven things. So bringing empiricism, bringing structure and funding and talent to these new ideas is something that DeSci World wants to push. It's quite inspiring, I think, in DeSci, more than just these great products, but the inspiration that it can bring to scientists to say, right, science is actually an open book. Go and find out what the truth you believe, see if it's true, test it, get funding and develop some thought processes around it, rather than just being like, that's some horse shit. you shouldn't look at that. It doesn't agree with what we think here in the Western, in the Western world. So that's, for me, that's a big thing.
So how did the conference go?
Well, it went very well. We had great presentation. Unfortunately, not that many people, but actually it seems that it's still like very early on in a very niche thing. So we're actually happy, or at least I, because actually all the right people were there. So the chemistry was perfect. So a little bit of context on that. So I was in Berlin last year, at the DSA Berlin, and I was inspired, and then I joined some of the Molecule DAOs, and then there was Eat Belgrade happening. And then I wanted to do this event, and then we got in touch. He wanted to do this event, and we're like, let's do the event together, which we did. And we're pretty happy with the outcome, I would say.
Yeah, some of the best content I've ever seen at a DSA conference. It's showing about the attendance.
We also did record everything, so we can share that. We have all the presentations recorded. It was really, really inspiring. And the idea from now on in Belgrade is to actually have community and do stuff, maybe meetups once a month or something like that. Because there are a lot of opportunities even for like engineers, builders, but also like for research centers, because for example, this Molecule, they are doing, they provide funding to like actual academic institutions, meaning that for example, a faculty X from Belgrade could actually apply for funds in a different way. And assumption is when you start like getting these, that's how you get involved mm-hmm. and hopefully start contributing to it globally. What's cool, it's like a global community. People are very open-minded and friendly, and it's still cozy because not that many people, like the biggest group, Telegram group, has like 800 members. That's probably like—
Now 1,000. It's actually
now
growing.
1,000. It's growing. But that's like 1,000 people in the whole world. Like probably everyone who knows anything is in there, which is exciting by itself. I don't know if you watched, if you saw that movie, 24-Hour Party People, about Manchester scene.
No.
Oh, but what's cool about that, it has this feeling. So there's this first Sex Pistols concert, and there's only like 15 people in the audience. But it seems that out of these 15 people, like 12 of them started like five iconic bands. So it has this element of like a very selected group of people who are extremely passionate.
It does feel like that. One attendee, guy called Kevin Ward from Etika Protocol, he built Etika Protocol maybe 3 years ago. It's really an OG DSI project, and he's a fantastic, one of the nicest men I've ever met in my life. And he said, you know, when we were reflecting on it afterwards at the bar, he was saying, you know, it felt to him like one of the early Bitcoin conferences. That's what he said. You know, it's optimistic mm-hmm. to think that, you know, we're so much further in the crypto space than back then. But he said he felt like that's what the vibe was, and that everybody was so, he said, cozy. The chemistry was great. The content was like AA grade content. Some of the best sort of speeches, some of the best presentations, some of the best debates. And because it was actually smaller in attendance, we got a lot of really interesting points of view. It felt very raw. And for us, that was a big success. So, you know, as Philip mentioned, DSI Belgrade is going to be active in Belgrade. So any DSI enthusiasts should contact Philip. There's a group chat. DSI World is going to, you know, so this was our pilot event in the World of DSI conference. So the DSI Belgrade community is, you know, the primary part of our incubation efforts of incubating DSI around the world. So we're going to support Philip and DSI Belgrade from the DSI World perspective for as much as possible, right? And with our networks, maybe with some funding in the future as we get better funded. So yeah, I mean, what a great city to do this with an illustrious history of someone who, for example, Nikola Tesla, who basically did decentralized science, right? He did science by himself without the support of the ecosystem, which was building around him in the Thomas Edison, for example. He was ousted, he was vilified, his inventions were sabotaged, and he was given no credit, and he died in some kind of squalor, right? And he was a great example of what science can be done when you think about things from a different angle, when you remove that intellectual capture that the US-led, in this historical case, the US-led system had captured the intellectual sort of framework, and he decided to go against that, and he was not allowed to do so. But DSI provides a framework that might allow you actually to do so.
What do you think is the greatest threat for DSI? Like, we know of a benefits in a way, we can deep dive into it, but maybe if there is a threat, and obviously everything that is exists has some threat. So,
like the threat to DSI or the threat of DSI?
Threat to DSI, like, and maybe even off, if it succeeds,
Yeah, does so it... for the threat of DeSci, what happens when you give unlimited access and unlimited freedom to people to do whatever science they want? Well, you can just imagine all kinds of crazy shit that's going to happen. And I think that that's something that is kind of unpreventable. And it's a sense, you know, it's this, this sort of a question around AI alignment, for example. How do you stop AI from destroying the world? You know, there's, depending on what you're, if you're a doomer, you're a white pilled or black pilled on it, you think it's going to be fine. Ultimately, I believe that the only way to stop these, you know, horrible eventualities is to raise the consciousness of the people in general, right? Because technology is just a tool and it's about how you wield it. And if you can sort of bring society up to a point where they don't want to use it to, you know, destroy everybody, then that's probably the only way to mitigate against these things. Because DeSci will, if it succeeds, decentralize access to powerful materials, powerful efforts. What's the biggest threat to DeSci? I mean, maybe what I just mentioned, right? Maybe someone doing something crazy and then the ban hammer coming down, the regulatory ban hammer coming down and saying, right, it's not, we're not allowed to do
this. This is not how you do science.
Yeah. And because someone did some crazy shit, now no one else can do it. That's a big concern. Another big concern is kind of regulatory capture, which people were worried about in DeFi in general, is in order to get that institutional integration, how much of our principles do we sell? Do we just become traditional academia on-chain? That's a big fear of mine. And in many ways, you can see that happening in some respects. But as I said, you know, scientists prefer that reputation. They prefer less anarchy. They prefer more order. So that's probably more likely to happen in DeSci than anything, is this sort of amalgamation of the system and the DeSci system becoming, you know, unrecognizable from each other.
One question that comes to my mind is concerning the scientists. Even though they are revolutionary, like in some way, they are, what's the right word? Let me go with lazy, but no, I'm not sure. Lazy in basically adopting new kinds of ways of basically with technology or ways of thinking. Like, let me do this in my way and that's it. So do you see that as also some kind of threat?
Yeah, I mean, so I've heard a lot of people say that scientists are creatures of habit.
Yeah, so something like that. Yeah. I'm not sure. This is the, like...
That's the sort of term that I think a lot of people would use to describe scientists that say, right, well, this works, so why would I change? And for a lot of scientists, it does work already. I was recently on stage in Split in Croatia with the mayor of Split, and he's a really fantastic man. He speaks multiple languages. He's a CERN scientist. Very, very smart, very, very talented, very interested person. And he, you know, he was so interested in DeSci that he actually moderated a panel in Blocksplit a couple of weeks ago. And I was lucky enough to speak to him on that panel. So we were speaking and the people on the panel were sort of joining me. They're a bit more, a bit more sort of conservative in sort of speaking out against the structural issues. I'm sure you're aware, don't really care so much about worrying. You know, I will speak out a little bit. And I mentioned the funding issue and he sort of said, you know, well, what's the problem with funding? And I said, well, you know, most of the funding is quite inefficient because the gains of science, in particular, the gains of the products of science accumulate to sort of corporations. And then he said, well, you know, I own stock in XXX. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, exactly, right? I don't. And the reason he was not excited about the revolutionary funding mechanisms, for example, is because it accrues to something that he's actually already a part of and it works for him. And that's what a lot of scientists will say, we'll be in that camp. The difference is that we're getting to a point now where for new young scientists in particular, it just isn't working for them. And I think that there's going to be an inflection point where scientists just don't have the interest in upholding that system anymore.
Philip, do you have something to add concerning basically the threats?
Well, there's something going terribly wrong. Like, I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of issues with, like, I don't know, on the technology side of things. There's also, like, it's still, like, complicated. Like, all these governance mechanisms are being tested. So something going terribly wrong can actually do harm for the movement. So I see that. And also, like, the U.S. government might be one of the biggest threats, especially with what's happening lately. So the legal side of things...
Yeah, no decentralization talk is complete without mentioning the threat of the U.S. government, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So
I do actually, I want to say a point on that because, you know, I've been very outspoken in private circles in the past about the role the US government has played in just controlling everything and for its own desires more than anything. But I will say some of the most innovative people in the world over the last 150 years were born and raised in the US. And the sort of American dream ethos, consciousness does bring this very innovative, groundbreaking sort of mindset. Because of, you know, for whatever, is it for personal gain? Maybe, but it's a great incentive, clearly, because a lot of fantastic innovations have come out of the US. And whilst right now, if you look at, you know, just even yesterday and the days before, Gary Gensler at the SEC has sued Binance and Coinbase. He's effectively shooting the American economy and the American innovation sector in the foot, you know, stifling their ability to access DeFi and crypto, it's so obscene. Right, it's so obviously counterproductive, so obviously counter innovation, that the American people will not stand for it. And I give it less than 2 years until, you know, the next election cycle, for example, until someone replaces Gary Gensler. His tenancy is up in 2026. His term is up. I wonder if he'll be ousted before that. And I think that there will be, through the democratic system, installed some new pro innovation, pro crypto innovation people. And I think DeSci will actually thrive in places like the US. More than other places, actually. Eastern Europe is actually getting a lot of attention through the network state, for example. Zuzalu was in Montenegro. But I do believe that the US has a very innovative spirit about it. And if the American social system doesn't crush that spirit, which I do think it's trying to do, but if it doesn't crush that spirit, which I think will be hard, then I think DeSci will have a renaissance there and innovation will go. So you can't stop it. You can't stop progress, right? But hopefully you can do it in the right way.
It's very interesting to actually read about how some of the major US cities would actually bootstrap like 100 and something years ago. So I think that like having that mindset, this experience can actually be beneficial for a lot of these things because people can actually organize, buy land and do whatever they want because they have that experience. Mm-hmm. As their attitude towards reality. So
if you look at the old pictures of Chicago, if you've seen some of the old photos of Chicago, that place is beautiful. It's like some old, like almost like a Roman Renaissance era city. I mean, it looks like crap now, but they do have that in their consciousness.
Well, one final question. If I was a scientist, what would be my next step after listening to this podcast? Like, what would you recommend?
Go to DeSci.world. Go to our app, take a look at the 80 plus projects building, see what takes your fancy, join their communities through our platform or reach out to us and we will connect you because that is what we're here for. We're the gateway to decentralized science, right? So if you feel like there's no place for you, maybe you can build your own project or maybe you can join another, but definitely come and take a look at some of the innovation and some of the exciting things being built in DeSci.
Philip, do you have something to add concerning the next steps for scientists?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense because just find the community. That's what, like, for example, people here, unfortunately, not that well connected with people from all over the world and joining like any DAO, like not necessarily by paying any money, but just like entering a Discord can be such an amazing experience because all of a sudden, like you think you're a freak interested in something stupid and then you find like a person from Japan, like even passionate like you are. And so I think that's like probably the first step, this amazement of actually finding people you might actually collaborate with. And there are cool articles, like one-on-one articles, and definitely the dashboard they're building because it's perfect overview of what's actually happening. So as a first
join
step.
Join DeSci Belgrade.
And yeah, of course.
You know, if you're in Belgrade, come to the DeSci Belgrade meetups.
Great. Thank you for this really nice talk about DeSci. Obviously, we didn't deep dive into all the topics, but I think we got a grasp of the main point for me was a trifle, and I understood DeSci better in that term. When I now understand better, like Ethereum has a DeSci page.
It does, yeah.
But you basically described it better. So thanks for this, and hope we will talk soon about more stuff happening in DeSci.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you.